Pushkin.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile App is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
What? Oh my goodness. Radiolab.
Whoa.
Adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
This has been the century of the superhero movie in Hollywood, which means it's been the century of intellectual property. Based on a comic book, based on a true story, and now based on a doll. The smash success of the Barbie movie is poised to usher a new era of movies based on a very peculiar kind of intellectual property, toys. But what's interesting is that Barbie, the doll, has, from its very beginnings, been a story about intellectual property, IP theft, and the relationship between intellectual property and feminism. Today on the show, Jill Lepore reads her essay on that tangled history. It was written before the film was made, but it's really apt now. So stick around after the essay to hear me and Jill talk about Barbie.
Well, I was in the theater, sold out theater. People were like standing up and clapping and screaming. And I was like, how are we watching the same movie?
Here's Valley of the Dolls.
Valley of the Dolls. Bratz dolls have swollen heads, pouty lips, spindly limbs, and chunky-heeled shoes. Their waists are barely wider than their necks. Their eyes and heads are so big, and their noses so small, that if it weren't for their penthouse makeup, icy eyeshadow, cat eyeliner, glistening lip gloss, and eyelashes as long as their fingers, and their come-hither clothes, crop tops, hot pants, micro-minis, and kinky boots, they'd look like emaciated babies, Cupie dolls in a time of famine. Carter Bryant was 31 and working at Mattel in August of 2000, designing clothes for Barbie, when he created Bratz, though he later said, in his legal defense turned on this claim, that he'd got the idea for the dolls while on a 7-month break from Mattel 2 years earlier. He drew some sketches of clothes-obsessed, bratty-looking teenagers. The girls with a passion for fashion, he called them, and made a prototype by piecing together bits and bobs that he found in a trash bin at work and in his own collection at home. A doll head, a plastic body, and Ken boots. He meant for his brats to come in pick-your-own skin colors and to have monetizably vague ethnic names. 2 weeks before Bryant quit Mattel, he sold his idea to a Mattel competitor, MGA Entertainment, which brought out 4 Bratz girls in 2001, Jade, Chloe, Yasmin, and Sasha. The first dolls to successfully rival Barbie since she made her debut in 1959 in a zebra-striped swimsuit and stilettos, eyebrows arched, waist pinched. Mattel sued Bryant. Mattel sued MGA. MGA sued Mattel. In the course of years of legal wrangling, hundreds of millions of dollars changed hands. But I'm afraid I couldn't possibly tell you exactly how much, because, as Talking Barbie used to say, her pull string wriggling, math class is tough. The feud between Barbie and Bratz occupied the narrow space between thin lines, between fashion and porn, between originals and copies, and between toys for girls and rights for women. In 2010, Alex Kaczynski, then the chief judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, who presided over Mattel versus MGA, wrote in his opinion that most of what makes a fashion doll desirable is not protectable intellectual property, because there are only so many ways to make a female body attractive. Little girls buy fashion dolls with idealized proportions, which means slightly larger heads, eyes, and lips, slightly smaller noses and waists, and slightly longer limbs than those that appear routinely in nature, Kaczynski wrote, giving slightly a meaning I never knew it had. But only so much exaggeration is possible, he went on. Make the head too large or the waist too small, and the doll becomes freakish. I'd explain how it is that anyone could look at either a Barbie or a Bratz doll and not find it freakish, except that such an explanation is beyond me. As a pull-string Barbie knockoff once told Lisa Simpson, "Don't ask me, I'm just a girl." In 2017, Orly Lobel, a professor at the University of San Diego School of Law, published You Don't Own Me, How Mattel versus MGA Entertainment Exposed Barbie's Dark Side. For the book, a hair-raising account of a Barbie dreamhouse-sized jarndice v. jarndice, Lobel interviewed Judge Kaczynski over lunch and happened to mention that when she was a girl, her mother, a psychologist, told her that Barbie dolls were bad for girls' body image. Kaczynski professed astonishment. The only thing wrong that I saw when I held Barbie, he said joking, is when I lifted her skirt, there's nothing underneath. In 2017, Kaczynski resigned from the federal judiciary after more than a dozen women, including two of his own former law clerks, accused him of inappropriate behavior. Justice is hard! Before Barbie, dolls were babies, to be fed and burped and bathed and wheeled around in prams and put down for naps. Barbie, who has hips and breasts, was a ripoff of a magnificently racy German doll called Lili. Lili was inspired by the title character in a Playboy-style comic strip. She works as a secretary, but is usually barely dressed, like the time she shows up at the office in a bikini. "So dumb," she says. "When I wake up this morning, I think I'm still on vacation." "Gentlemen prefer Lili," her slogan went. Ruth Handler, who co-founded Mattel with her husband in 1945, bought more than a dozen Lilies while on a tour of Europe with her children, Barbara and Ken, in 1956. She had the dolls shipped back home in California and charged the Mattel designer Jack Ryan, a lesser Hugh Hefner, with making an American Lili. Handler's husband declared that she was anatomically perfect. Mattel introduced its doll as Barbie, teenage fashion model. Ruth Handler elaborated on Barbie's German origins only after Ryan, a man she called the world's greatest swinger, began claiming that the idea for Barbie was his, not hers. "He couldn't think of anything original," Handler said about Ryan, "but once you let him and said what he should make, then he figured out how to make it happen." Handler said she named the doll after her daughter, but Ryan insisted that he was the one who named her after a different Barbara, his wife. Another of Ryan's five wives, Zsa Zsa Gabor, claimed, after divorcing him, that she hadn't been able to bear the fur-lined sex dungeon in his Bel Air mansion. In 1961, Lili's manufacturer sued Mattel, charging that the company had copied Lili one-to-one, having modified her only very slightly, et voila, Barbie was created. Handler liked to say that Lili was a freak, that she had an elongated and distorted kind of look, while Barbie was entirely natural. "I wanted an American teenager, but I wanted a narrow waist, narrow ankles, and boobs," Handler said. In fact, the two dolls are nearly identical. Mattel settled the case out of court and bought Lili's copyright in 1964. In 1978, Handler, having been investigated by the Securities and Exchange Commission, was indicted for fraud. She maintained her innocence but pleaded no contest. 2 years later, Ryan sued Mattel. Mattel settled. In 1991, after suffering a stroke, Ryan shot himself in the head. Handler, who after battling breast cancer had founded a company, Nearly Me, that made prosthetic breasts, died in 2002, the year Bratz won the Toy of the Year award. Notwithstanding her lurid origins, Barbie was the world's top-selling toy for girls for half a century. Mattel is believed to have sold nearly a billion Barbie dolls. Sales have lately been falling, despite Mattel's introduction in 2016 of body diversity Barbies that come in different sizes, shapes, and colors. Still, 9 in 10 American girls between the ages of 3 and 10 own at least one Barbie doll. And even without counting all those buried in landfills, there might well be more Barbies in the United States than there are people. Barbie is both a relic from another era and a bellwether of changing ideas about women in work, sex, and men. Her 1959 debut coincided with the release of the erotically charged film Pillow Talk. Doris Day, who looks something like Barbie, plays an extravagantly fashionable interior decorator, obliged to share a party line with a rakish playboy, Rock Hudson. They flirt over the phone. "This career girl had everything but love," the film's trailer announced, introducing the most sparkling sexcapade that ever winked at convention. The playboy has a switch in his apartment with which he can lock the door from the couch so that his dates can't escape. The interior decorator, who fends off all manner of advances from her clients, wants nothing more than to be carried into the playboy's lair. Much of the winking at convention had to do with Hudson's sexuality. At one point, he plays a straight man pretending to be a gay man. At another point, he is taken for a pregnant man. In 1961, Barbie began dating Ken, a Rock Hudson lookalike named after Ruth Handler's son. Their sexcapade sparkled. "I have a date tonight," an early talking Barbie said in 1968. "Would you like to go shopping?" Originally marketed to girls between the ages of 9 and 12, the career girl and her beach blanket bingo boyfriend weathered the women's movement and the sexual revolution by appealing each year to younger and younger children, which also made Barbie appear, each year, older and older. By the 1990s, when 3 out of 4 women between 25 and 54 worked outside the home, and Mattel was taking in $1 billion annually in Barbie sales alone, Barbie had become a plaything for 3-year-olds, girls who wore footy pajamas and pull-up diapers and who drank out of sippy cups, girls who were still toddlers. Barbie wasn't their baby. Barbie wasn't the teenager they wanted to grow up to be. Barbie was their mommy. If Pillow Talk marked the advent of Barbie, the movie version of Bridget Jones's Diary, released in theaters in 2001, marked the debut of Bratz. At a failing London publishing house, another career girl, played by Renee Zellweger, works for Daniel Cleaver, played by Hugh Grant. Much of their office flirting, conducted not by telephone but by email, concerns her clothes, micro minis and see-through blouses. Bratz clothes. Daniel: "If walking past my office was an attempt to demonstrate presence of skirt, can only say that it has failed parlously." Cleve: "Bridget, shut up, please. I am very busy and important. P.S. How dare you sexually harass me in this impertinent manner?" Daniel: "Message Jones, mortified to have caused offense. Will avoid all non-PC overtones in future. Deeply apologetic. P.S. Like your tits in that top." MGA sold $97 million worth of Bratz dolls in 2001 and $1 billion worth in 2003. Mattel began to panic. To the press, as Lobel recounts, Isaac Larian, MGA's CEO, offered all sorts of explanations about where the idea for Bratz had come from, including from a focus group or from his daughter, Jasmine. Eventually, according to Lobel, an anonymous letter tipped Mattel off to the truth. Bratz had been created not by Isaac Larian or by any of his children, but by Carter Bryant, who, when he was hired by Mattel, had signed an intellectual property agreement. Everything he created during his employment at Mattel, it said, belonged to Mattel. What does it mean to own an idea? Oren Bracha, a professor at the University of Texas School of Law, asks in Owning Ideas, The Intellectual Origins of American Intellectual Property, 1790-1909. Intellectual property takes the form of patents and copyrights, legal instruments derived from the practices of 15th-century Italian republics. In Anglo-American law, the first patents and copyrights were issued in the 16th century. Although they weren't rights, they were privileges, favors granted by the crown, such as the patent that Elizabeth I granted to Sir Walter Raleigh in 1584 for the discovery of Virginia and to have hold and enjoy the said land, or the copyright that James I granted in 1611 to printers of what became known as the King James Bible. As Bracha points out, early patents and copyrights were not understood to involve ideas. That transformation came in the course of the 18th century, When the courts began to understand ideas as things that could be owned, and ownership of them as having the characteristics of property rights. In 1787, patents and copyrights had only lately taken on this meaning and force in English common law when the U.S. Constitution granted Congress the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing, for limited times to authors and inventors, the exclusive rights to their respective writings and discoveries. In the late 18th century, a property in ideas came to rest in authors and inventors on the theory, foundational to possessive individualism, that the act of creation is the act of an individual. Not everyone agreed with this premise, which pits the property rights of authors and inventors against a public interest in books and inventions. Benjamin Franklin famously refused to patent any of his inventions on the ground that, he explained, as we enjoy great advantages from the inventions of others, we should be glad of an opportunity to serve others by any invention of ours, and this we should do freely and generously. Few followed his lead. Instead, 19th century Americans democratized invention, according to the economist Zarina Khan, granting to ordinary people as a universal right what had once been a privilege granted to an elite few. They also adopted a romantic notion of authorship, fetishizing the originality of the fevered Byronic genius, though jurists like the Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story found the standard of unstained originality all but useless for adjudicating copyright disputes. No man creates a new language for himself, at least if he be a wise man, Story wrote. Virgil borrowed much from Homer, and even Shakespeare and Milton, so justly and proudly our boast as the brightest originals, would be found to have gathered much from the abundant stores of current knowledge and classical studies in their days. The reason to protect a property in ideas, at least originally, was to promote creativity, both by rewarding authors and inventors for what they do, and by, after a fixed time, releasing their ideas into the world. The standard of originality in intellectual property has historically been low, because everything to some degree copies, at least part of something else. Good ideas are cobbled together out of other ideas, even bad ideas, and for people to keep having new ideas, old ideas have to be set free. As Louis Brandeis explained in 1918, the general rule of law is that the noblest of human productions, knowledge, truths ascertained, conceptions and ideas, become, after voluntary communication to others, free as the air to common use. The reign of authors and inventors began coming to a close in the 1880s with the rise of corporate liberalism. Authors and inventors there might still be, but when they were employees, their employers owned their ideas. Corporate ownership of ideas, the dramatic extension of the terms of copyright, and a wild expansion of what counts as protectable intellectual property have together undermined the original purpose of intellectual property law. 9 out of 10 patents granted in the United States are now owned by corporations. Congress passed 10 Copyright Extension Acts in the course of the 20th century. Copyright now lasts for 70 years after the death of the author. Corporations have attempted to claim exclusive legal rights to everything from yoga moves to genetic sequences. Lucasfilm, George Lucas's company, sued two lobbying groups over the use of the phrase Star Wars to refer to the Reagan administration's proposed missile defense system, and licenses the word droid to Verizon, even though it was coined in the 1950s, 20 years before Lucasfilms used it in Star Wars. By the 1990s, especially after the passage of the soi-disant Mickey Mouse Protection Act in 1998, a growing number of legal scholars had begun to question the basic assumptions of intellectual property law, wondering whether it has ever done what it was meant to do. Insisting on a freedom to copy, they argued that the private rights of corporations were overrunning the public interest. The central narrative of intellectual property law, that legal protection against copying is necessary in order to promote creative behavior, has been subjected to surprisingly little scrutiny, Kate Darling and Aaron Pezanowski observed in Creativity Without Law, Challenging the Assumptions of Intellectual Property, a collection of essays that looked at creative artists whose work has thrived outside the regime of intellectual property, including chefs, bartenders, pornographers, and tattoo and graffiti artists. Tattoos are protectable intellectual property, but nearly all tattoo artists operate outside that legal realm, following instead a set of industry norms. Pornography, which has historically been the first to adopt and adapt to new technologies, is generally lax about copyright enforcement, and has instead devised a new business model based on sharing not content, but experiences. By operating outside intellectual property law, each of these industries has thrived, both creatively and economically. A countercase could be made that industries that are vigilant about copyright infringement, action figure franchises, say, or television sitcoms, may have made a lot of money for the corporations that own them, but the results have not generally been distinguished for their creativity. Calls for reform, often sounded, have not been heeded. One of the loudest and sharpest critics of the intellectual property corporate rampage was Judge Kaczynski. "Overprotecting intellectual property is as harmful as underprotecting it," he wrote, long before issuing his opinion in Mattel versus MGA. As Lobel reports, Kaczynski is that rare bird, a judicial celebrity. He hobnobs with Hollywooders and kept his own IMDb page, where he had personally rated more than 1,000 films. A movie buff and a libertarian, Kaczynski was also a free speech advocate, a position that extends to both pornography and intellectual property. In one notable opinion, a dissent in a copyright case in which the producers of Wheel of Fortune had complained about a Vanna White robot in a Samsung ad, Kaczynski wrote, "We call this creativity, not piracy." Kaczynski, in other words, would appear to agree with Joseph Story and Louis Brandeis. "Nobody writes anything from scratch," he said in an interview in 2006. "We all build on the past from a shared public domain of ideas." In one of the darker ironies of this saga, Kaczynski, a jurist known for his promotion of the freedom to copy, was felled by a social movement that involves the repetition of endlessly similar stories and calls itself Me Too. "They cannot keep making dolls like this. Something has to be done," Lisa Simpson fumes hopelessly in a 1994 episode of The Simpsons. If sexy dolls for little girls have never strayed far from either pornography or debates about intellectual property, they've also never strayed far from the politics of the workplace. When Lisa and Marge visit the doll company to complain, a man in a suit whistles from a boardroom to their tour guide, "Hey, Jiggles, grab a pad and back that gorgeous butt in here." Miffed, Lisa comes up with her own idea for a doll. A doll with the tenacity of Nina Totenberg and the common sense of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and to top it off, the down-to-earth good looks of Eleanor Roosevelt. She sells exactly one. Her intellectual property is worthless. As Kaczynski would write in his opinion in Mattel versus MGA, it's possible to make dolls that don't look like porn stars, but there's not a big market for fashion dolls that look like Patty and Selma Bouvier. A reference to Lisa Simpson's big-nosed, wide-waisted, thick-ankled ants. In 2004, which, as it happens, was the year that the Ninth Circuit Court Judge Alex Kaczynski was rated the number one male super hottie of the federal judiciary by the now-defunct legal gossip blog Underneath Their Robes, John Roberts, then a judge for the D.C. Circuit Court, was ranked number 5, Mattel sued MGA. As the case slowly made its way to trial, Bratz sales continued to soar. Marketed as multi-ethnic and often described as urban and street, Bratz dolls were celebrated for racial and ethnic diversity and greeted as markers of the browning of America. Their popularity in middle American suburbia tracked the spreading influence of hip-hop and rap, including hip-hop and rap's representation of girls and women. "Cutie the Bomb met her at a beauty salon," Kanye West rapped in the chart-topping Gold Digger in 2005, a best-selling Bratz year. "She went to the doctor, got lipo with your money." Mattel had been far worse than tone-deaf on race. It once released a doll called Oreo Barbie, which came in both black and white versions. But Bratz made race into a consumer accessory. And as the cultural critic Lisa Guerrero has pointed out, Jade, Chloe, Yasmin, Sasha, and the rest of the Bratz never work. They only shop. By 2006, the year the activist Tarana Burke founded an organization called Just Be, Inc. to raise awareness about the sexual abuse of black and brown girls using the slogan Me Too, Bratz dolls were outselling Barbies in England, Australia, and South Africa, and competing well in the United States, where sales of Barbie dolls were down 13%. Notwithstanding the introduction of the truly porny collector's edition, Lingerie Barbie, who, in a pink bustier and peekaboo peignoir, looks like nothing so much as a heavily drugged Marilyn Monroe about to pass out. Mattel versus MGA finally reached a California district court in 2008, the year that Judge Kaczynski, who, if the stories told about him are to be believed, appears to have fancied himself a "like your tits in that top" sort of boss, was the subject of a judicial inquiry for posting pornographic images to his public website, alexkaczynski.com. The images included, according to the Los Angeles Times, a photo of naked women on all fours painted to look like cows. Perhaps inevitably, pornography played a role in the Mattel case, too. During the discovery phase of the initial trial, Lobel reports, a California district court judge granted Mattel's attorneys permission to scan Carter Bryant's computer for evidence. On that computer, they found pornography and also software used to wipe hard drives. During the trial, the judge allowed Mattel's lawyer to introduce the pornography as evidence and to question him about it. In the end, the district court jury ruled in Mattel's favor, awarding the company $100 million, a tenth of the $1 billion that Mattel had sought. Kaczynski, meanwhile, was reprimanded for posting pornography, but after apologizing and shutting down his website, he remained on the bench, which is how he came to adjudicate the Doll Wars, when, on appeal, Mattel versus MGA went to Kaczynski's court in 2009, Barbie's 50th birthday. "Who owns Bratz?" Kaczynski asked at the opening of his landmark opinion. "Not Mattel," was his answer, in a ruling in which he listed a series of errors made by the lower court, including its finding that the features of an idealized female body were ideas that anyone could own. "America thrives on competition," Kaczynski declared. "Barbie, the all-American girl, will too." Kaczynski's ruling sent the case back to the district court for a second trial, where, as Lobel expertly explains, much turned on MGA's lawyer, Jennifer Keller's questioning of the Mattel CEO, Robert Eckert. "Say I am 18 doodling away. I place my doodles in my parents' house in one of the drawers of my teenage closet," Keller said. 20 years later, I am hired by Mattel. I visit my parents' home and find the doodles. Does Mattel own them?" "Yes," Eckert said. "Probably yes." Aghast at Mattel's absurd overreach, the jury not only found against Mattel, but found in favor of MGA's countersuit. The judge awarded MGA more than $300 million in damages. Some legal scholars thought that an appeal of Kaczynski's opinion might carry Barbie versus Bratz to the Supreme Court. That never happened, but the legal battle went on with yet another lawsuit. The intellectual property issues raised by the case have not been resolved, nor have the weightier matters of the intellectual independence of girls or the relationship between men and women at work. Once told to be hotties, even judges wanted to be hotties, girls were next told to empower themselves by being hot employees, as both the culture and corporations set aside longstanding concerns about sexual harassment in the workplace, abandoning possible societal, industry-wide, or even governmental remedies in favor of sex-positive corporate feminism. The 2013 publication of Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In marked a steepening in the decline of structural efforts to reform workplaces. Instead of fighting for equal pay, equal work, and family leave, women were told that they needed to empower themselves one by one through power dressing and personal exertion. Unsurprisingly, Barbie and Bratz leaned in too. MGA relaunched Bratz with the latest mindless lingo of corporate-friendly girl power in a box. "We have doctors, lawyers, journalists," MGA's CEO, Isaac Larian, told Forbes. "Now, more than ever, Bratz empowers girls." The rebranded dolls, though, had no discernible interest in such careers. Instead, the Bratz, who, like Barbie, started out as teenagers, now came with hobbies, including yoga and running, and wardrobes newly inspired by study abroad travel. Mattel ran its own Sandbergian campaign. "When a girl plays with Barbie, she imagines everything she can become," and promoted Dr. Barbie, who, with her stethoscope, wears stilettos, a miniskirt, and a white lab coat embroidered in pink thread, Barbie. Empowerment feminism is a cynical sham. As Margaret Talbot once noted in The New Yorker, to change a Bratz doll's shoes, you have to snap off its feet at the ankles. That is pretty much what girlhood feels like. In a 2014 study, girls between 4 and 7 were asked about possible careers for boys and girls after playing with either Fashion Barbie, Dr. Barbie, or, as a control, Mrs. Potato Head. The girls who'd played with Mrs. Potato Head were significantly more likely to answer yes to the question, "Could you do this job when you grow up?" when shown a picture of the workplaces of a construction worker, a firefighter, a pilot, a doctor, and a police officer. The study had a tiny sample size, and like most slightly nutty research in the field of social psychology, has never been replicated or scaled up, except that since nearly all American girls own a Barbie, the population of American girls has been the subject of the scaled-up version of that experiment for nearly six decades. Me Too arises from the failure of empowerment feminism. Women have uncannily similar and all too often harrowing and even devastating stories about things that have happened to them at work, because men do very similar things to women. Leaning in doesn't help. There's more copying going on, too. Pornography and accounts of sexual harassment follow the same script. Nobody writes anything from scratch. Abandoning structural remedies and legislative reform for the politics of personal charm, leaning in, dressing for success, being Dr. Barbie, left women in the workplace with few choices but to shut up and lean in more and to dress better. It's no accident that Me Too started in the entertainment and television news businesses, where women are required to look as much like Barbie and Bratz dolls as possible, with the help of personal trainers, makeup artists, hairstylists, personal shoppers, and surgeons. Unfortunately, an extrajudicial crusade of public shaming of men accused of sexual misconduct is no solution and a poor kind of justice, not least because it brooks no dissent, as if all that women are allowed to say about Me Too is, "Me too." The pull string wriggles. Inevitably, the doll wars met up with the sex wars. "The only thing wrong that I saw when I held Barbie is when I lift her skirt, there's nothing underneath." In December, Kaczynski resigned from the bench after the Washington Post reported on allegations of sexual harassment made by at least 15 women. In a statement, Kaczynski referred to his broad sense of humor and said, "It grieves me to learn that I caused any of my clerks to feel uncomfortable." Two of his former clerks assert that he asked them to look at pornography with him in his chambers. "What do single girls in San Francisco do for sex?" he allegedly asked another clerk, which is the sort of thing Rock Hudson's Pillow Talk character would say. Dahlia Lithwick, Slate's legal correspondent, met Kaczynski in 1996 when she was clerking for another judge. "I cannot recall what we talked about," Lithwick later wrote. "I remember only feeling quite small and very dirty." Kaczynski sounds like the sort of person who may have snapped a lot of people's feet off at the ankles. No results of any formal investigation have been announced. "Would you please let me know if I owe you," Ruth Handler wrote once upon a time to the store in Germany where she'd placed an order for a shipment of Lily dolls, their breasts pert, lips plump. The consequences of that purchase remain incalculable. Mattel owns Barbie, MGA owns Bratz, and corporations still own the imaginations of little girls. 2018.
Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you, who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase, N.A. member FDIC, 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Co.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
So, do you want to talk about Barbie the film, or do you want to skirt the question?
Look, I'm brave.
I guess it's one of the things that's interesting to me about this essay is the entire thing is about Barbie through the lens of intellectual property,
mm-hmm.
and yet it, by several years, predates the film,
right?
Or even the knowledge of the film, which is like the new era in Hollywood / Mattel intellectual property. Like now we've got all these
right.
Mattel doll right. films coming out,
right?
How did you land on the intellectual property frame for understanding Barbie? Like, of all the ways to write a Barbie essay, why does this one have a lengthy history of intellectual property section?
There was a book, which I forget the title of, it's in the article, that was just coming out that was quite specifically about the Bratz Barbie battle. And then I, for years, had wanted to write a book about the history of copyright. And part of my obsession with writing a book about Charles Dickens was as a way to narrativize the story of copyright reform in the 19th century, because Dickens came to the United States in order to lobby for international copyright in Congress. So I have fair background as like a legal historian in the history of copyright. And then, so I gathered together a bunch of other books about, fairly new books about intellectual property and the history of intellectual property, which I think is really, really interesting. So. When I sat down to write the piece, though, because I have this rule, I've very seldom broken, that every piece I write, with, even if it's just a straight book review, has to involve a kind of original archival discovery, or at least, you know, very fresh to me. And Ruth Handler's papers are at Radcliffe. So I should have, like, walk from my house to Radcliffe. It wasn't, like, a hard thing to do to go read Ruth Handler's papers. And they have in them, like, the receipt from the Lily doll that she buys for her kids, Ken and Barbie, when she goes to Germany on this family trip. And, like, there's just quite a lot of rich stuff in there that anybody writing about Barbie or Handler would want to look at, but that I had never seen. But none of the books that were involved in the kind of dealing with the legal history of IP were interested in the dolls as dolls and the idea that dolls play a role in what is imaginable for girls, which is this whole other discourse of the kind of Lisa Simpson version. And I'm always in agreement with Lisa Simpson. I think it's pretty much a universal rule. So, yeah, I think the challenge in writing the piece was trying to make the intellectual property part interesting, because it is really important. But I was also writing this piece somewhere near the height of the Me Too movement, from which I felt a considerable amount of alienation and wanted to kind of keep myself at arm's length from, but also needed to see the doll battle in that context to some degree. So the piece is trying to do a lot of things. It's trying to offer up a fairly sustained critique of empowerment feminism, of which the Barbie movie that subsequently came out several years later is a really good example. I can't stand empowerment feminism from the Sheryl Sandberg version to the Greta Gerwig version. I just think it's a bankrupt way of thinking about equality. This is actually completely counter to the idea of equality or community or values and caretaking and love, than anything that I really care about. It just doesn't have anything to do with. So I wanted to offer that as a kind of sustained critique, while also offering kind of history of intellectual property, and then also having the piece hopefully be fun, because you can't really write about toys and have it be deadly, or you're really not doing your job.
So in the archive, is that where you found the Tell Me What I Owe You letter to the German manufacturer of Lily?
Yeah.
Part of what I loved about bringing Lily into the picture in it is you have this doll that just, like, it is like a sexual joke. Like, the cartoon is super sexual.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the American flavor of all of this, mm-hmm. in which the way you write about it is everything is like super sexed, but just kind of like unacknowledged and bubbling under the surface. Mm-hmm. Like the doll's kind of pornographic, but like she's a doctor, but she's like a hot dog. Like what?
Yeah.
It's even like the judge becoming like the male number one super hottie posting porn on his blog.
Right.
You just feel like there's sex bursting out of the seams of everything in America, but like nobody wants to admit that that's what's going on.
Yeah. I also thought the thing, which I hadn't really thought about, because when I was working on a piece, I talked to like every single person I knew about their Barbie history. Like, did you have dolls? Did you give girl dolls? You know, if you have daughters, would you give them dolls? I asked like every single person that I met or knew or, you know, hung out with in any way. And I had to like ask my students. So I really became kind of struck by the idea that when Barbie was first manufactured and marketed, it was for sort of slightly older girls to be like an 8 to 10 year old kind of imagining themselves as teenagers. And little girls still had baby dolls because they had that kind of like attachment thing of mothering the baby. And that the baby doll's kind of gone and you see like 2 year olds with Barbies and it's, what is that?
That's really weird.
Like that's... The average age of the owner of Barbie dolls has gotten younger and younger and younger. And Barbie has gotten in some ways like older and older and older in the sense that she was like kind of coded as like 15 or 17 when she started maybe. But now she's a judge or a doctor, right? So, well, I don't know, is she 35? She still looks that way. Like it's a weird erasure of the stages of life of babies, girls, women, mothers, widows, whatever. It's just so monstery at every level. Like it just looks like a monster to me. So I wanted to try to capture some of that sensibility, which is where like a Lisa Simpson comes in handy. Because Lisa's whole thing is like, look at this.
Yeah. One of the things that really bothers me about the Barbie movie is... it just like it ingests all of this criticism and then it turns it into the property of Mattel.
Mm-hmm.
Like the film in so many ways vocalizes these sorts of critiques of Mattel and of Barbie, but then turns it ultimately into a story that reaffirms Barbie's primacy. And in fact, America Ferrera's character's daughter literally is the Lisa Simpson character.
Yeah.
She is a person who's like, this is not good for us. This Arrested Development mother.
Right.
This is like not an okay.
But yeah, you must ride in the Dreammobile.
Right. And then she comes around. The emotional arc of the film partially is her learning to love Barbie.
Yeah.
Why do you think people are not bothered by this? Because it's like...
I don't know. I am completely mystified by the love for the Barbie movie. I love Greta Gerwig. I hate everything about that movie. And I don't hate a lot of movies. Like, I'm not like a big movie hater. But I was in the theater, sold out theater. People were like standing up and clapping and screaming. And I was like, how are we watching the same movie? This is a bad movie, but it's also everything about it is culturally opposed to everything I care about. So I was still like, and this is what feminism is in 2023, 2024? I was baffled.
Hi, Lost Archive listeners. I want to tell you about another podcast to add to your queue, The Jordan Harbinger Show. Jordan's podcast is aimed at making you a better informed critical thinker so you can come to your own conclusions about what's happening in the world. He dives into the minds of fascinating people, from authors and activists to mobsters, spies, and hostage negotiators. You might enjoy Jordan's interview with Yuval Noah Harari, the author of Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, or his recent deep dive into modern flat earth theory and why some still believe the earth is flat despite thousands of years of evidence to the contrary. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you'll find something useful you can apply to your own life in every episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show, whether it's asking for advice the right way or discovering a slight mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show, that's H-A-R-B-I-N-G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you listen to podcasts.